the interesting thing about that is like, these are people who I was with like, you know, 6 months ago, and my business wasn't very interesting to them. It was like, yeah, here's this thing that we do. And they were like, oh yeah, Henry has a business.
Hey, thank you so much for tuning in to Going Deep with Aaron Watson. This is one of my favorite interviews that I've gotten to share in a very long time. Henry Schuck just completed a successful IPO of Zoom Info that now, at the time of this recording, has a market cap of about $20 billion. And in this forthcoming interview, you're going to hear exactly how his attention to detail, his commitment to improving his company metrics, his tenacity, his intensity contributed to this very rare feat and accomplishment. Henry gets real about the importance of cold calling and sales efforts and talks about how he bootstrapped his company to $25 million in annual revenue before taking on outside investment. His company, Zoom Info, is a sales intelligence platform. So what they do is help their clients understand the org chart, the emails, the phone numbers, and other relevant data associated with the B2B targets that they would be reaching out to. It's been built into a very big, very effective business in a crowded and competitive space. I was really glad that Henry took the time to come on this show, and I think that you're going to take a lot away from it. I learned a lot. Here is Henry Schuck.
You're listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
Thanks for coming on the podcast, man. I'm excited that you're spending some time with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Aaron.
So to start things off, you've had a exceptionally busy past month or so leading up to ZoomInfo's IPO on June 4th. We're recording this, it's the 10th. And you literally, before we started recording, shared that this is the first interview post-IPO. Previously, your spots were on Bloomberg and Jim Cramer. So what was it like being on those type of platforms, talking about the company that you've been building for 13 years?
Yeah, it was a little bit surreal. I told my wife that I was much more nervous about the live television than I was about like the roadshow or the conversations with investors. You kind of get used to those, but being, you know, lights, camera, action, and live across the world was a little bit terrifying. So more than anything, I'm glad that's over for now. But look, I think what was really exciting for me, or just, you know, touching, was seeing how all of our employees reacted about the company on social media. Like seeing people say, like, I'm so proud of the company I work for. I'm so excited about the future of the company. I made the best decision of my life 5 years ago when I came to work at ZoomInfo. And you know, that was really cool because you think about trying to build the best company you possibly can. And you try to do all the right things for your employees and your customers and your shareholders. And there are a few moments where people actually share their like genuine feeling about what you've built. And so it was really cool to hear everybody say like, to feel really a part of this and then to acknowledge like what we've built here is really exciting and it's fun to be a part of. And it drives like major career transformations for people. And so that part was really cool.
And you referenced comparing the live TV to the roadshow, and a standard process of taking a company public is this roadshow where you go and talk to group of investor after group of investor after group of bankers over and over, and the reading books like The New Thing, there's a monotony to it because it's more or less the same pitch. Maybe there's a little tweaking. But what was that process like doing it in the midst of a pandemic where no one's traveling anywhere and you're probably just like living in Zoom like everyone else?
So what's interesting is I had this moment, I started doing these kind of like investor meetings early on after TA made an investment in what was called Discover Org at the time, now Zoom Info, in 2014. Where, you know, investment banks will set up sort of a day of meetings for you in a hotel. So you get like a hotel room and then investors, public or private investors, start coming and meeting you. And you do the same pitch over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And I think the first time I did that, I had this moment where we were in this hotel room and it was the towards the end of my day, and these two investors came in and we're having the same conversation. They asked me sort of the same question that, you know, the seven other investors before them asked me. And I literally couldn't tell if I had told them the same snippet or I had just told the person before or three before. And so I took this moment where I was like, I'm sorry, did I just say this to you or have I not said this to you? And they're like, no, you haven't said this to me. And they say like, oh, we understand what this must be like. You've done all these meetings. But I don't think you really understand how like confusing of a situation that is in your mind, because you're like, oh my, I literally can't remember if it was you I said these words to or somebody else. And you feel that same way in the roadshow in real life. And so we did a couple of testing the waters where you kind of do a mini roadshow. Like it's 2 days, you go meet with a bunch of investors, it's like 8 meetings a day. And you feel the same way in real life when you're going from office to office to office. And then in the Zoom roadshow, and we did all of our roadshow remotely. And so in the Zoom roadshow, you feel similar, like you're having the same conversation over and over. I would tell you what's really interesting is you can really tell by the questions investors ask you how well they understand your business, how well they understand the space, how well they, you know, how convicted they are about the opportunity in front of you. And so I don't think any of that was lost virtually. I think, you know, you hear people say like, you have to look into the whites of their eyes to really understand how much they believe in you and your business. The reality of the situation is you just have to listen to their questions to know how much they believe in your business and how much they trust you and how much they believe in the opportunity in front of you. And so that doesn't change whether you're in person with them or you're over Zoom. But yeah, we did a abbreviated roadshow all over Zoom on the lead up to the IPO.
And it's kind of a trope of basically just like sales training that you're going to build these little stories or have some yep. form of like your language that is repeated, whether it's you're selling the product or you're recruiting or you're investing in some capacity. Like that's always there. But to dial it up and have it be in such like, you know, consistent successive order like that just kind of dials it past whatever the normal bounds of the human brain are.
Yeah, totally. And I think the other piece of it is there's so much time spent on how you tell your story and how you make sense of the different parts of your business and how you make that sort of understandable for any investor you have that meeting with. And what's the beautiful part of that is if you do that well, then all of those ways you talk about the business find their way into the go-to-market engine at the company. They find their way into marketing collateral. They find their way into AE and AM talk tracks. That sort of crafts the story you also tell the market if you're doing it well. You know, so if you're telling the story really well to public company investors or, you know, private equity investors or VCs, that's the same story you're telling. There are pieces of that that's the same story you're telling your customers. It's the same story you're telling your employees. It's the same story you're telling your prospects. So that is like a great thing that comes out of these roadshows, whether they be with VCs or private equity firms or the IPO, is you really get this like extended focused opportunity to really dial in your story in a way that you know, anybody can understand.
And that's also part of it that like, this isn't the end of the road. You're not like racing to get out the door of Zoom Info. You're still aspiring to continue to grow it and build it and build on what you've done for the last 13 years. So you're yep. approaching it with that same iterative process.
Totally. I mean, everything is like, it's just a, you know, everything that we do is just a matter of how many iterations you do on them. Like if you do one iteration, I can promise you whatever you put out there is not very good. And so I think in all of the parts of our business, we're just in an iteration cycle. And even in the best parts of our business, like we run, in my opinion, I think in a lot of people's opinion, the most sophisticated and efficient go-to-market engine ever built. We have data scientists who are embedded into our go-to-market motion. We're looking at every single metric and figuring out how do we convert that a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit better. You know, when a lead for a financial services company comes into our website, who's the best SDR to transfer that to, who can book a demo? And when that demo gets booked, who's the best AE who's most likely to convert that demo? And we're using algorithms on the back end to make those decisions in real time. And we're generating a 10x LTV to CAC. Our sales cycles are less than 30 days, which is, you know, at a really respectable ASP. So we're doing real good work on the go-to-market engine. And it's in an iterate, you know, it's in a current iteration. You know, like we're going to tweak and tweak and tweak and tweak that every day forever. And so there is really no end on any of those things. And the other thing that I think I would say is, you know, when I think about how do we build our, what are we doing to build our business? I really want to build a business that in every single department, whether it's sales or marketing or product development or engineering or finance or accounts receivable, I want every single piece of that business to be literally best in class. I want anybody to come in and stumble into the accounts receivable function and go, wow, you guys are doing that better than anybody I've ever seen. And I want them to say it about engineering and product management and sales and marketing and content. Like, I want that for our business. And so that means like we have a lot of work to do everywhere. And even in places where I think today you could bring in an investor or bring in a customer and have them say, wow, that's the best, you know, inter the department I've ever seen. It's not going to be the best forever because other people are going to get better at, there are going to be new theories and new ways to get better in those departments. And so we're constantly just iterating any given process that we have.
And there's, I guess there's no great way to answer this because you've only known one experience as being the founder of ZoomInfo, but in terms of pushing for that, not just seeing it, but kind of having the ear and the trust and the pulse of an organization. You guys are up to like 1400 people now?
Yep.
In order to push for that, is it easier for it to come from your voice as the founder relative to other leadership on the team? Is that something that you almost feel like, when you distill down, like all these other departments have probably taken all sorts of stuff off of your hand as time has gone by, is that kind of the thing that remains for you to instill in the rest of the organization?
I mean, look, yes, and I'm instilling it in the rest of the organization, but it starts with me instilling it into my direct reports and the reports one level below my direct reports. We do this thing every month where we do a monthly operating review where you come, what every department has it, and we sit down and we go through how every department performed, metrics on everything from HR to BI to IT. And all you're really looking for in those moments is like, what did we do in the previous month that went really well? And can we do more of it? What did we do that didn't go very well? You know, should we do less of it or should we do it differently? And then a lot of those months, like we're a pretty successful company. And so nobody's doing like a really poor job. But you still come into that meeting and you leave with like, ah, you know, you could have done this better. We should probably do that better. What if we go look at this? And, you know, we should have been more focused on that. And so I have lots of moments where, you know, I had this moment with our head of account management, you know, a few months ago. We're coming out of this monthly operating review meeting, and they just had a great month. And, you know, it's an hour of us going like, yeah, but what about this segment over here? Engagement's not that great over here. Why didn't you, you know, put your foot down on these things? And he walked out of the meeting when we were walking out. He's like, huh, you know, like, what about the great month we just delivered? Like, nobody wants to talk about the great month we just delivered, huh? And I was like, you just get used to this, man. Like, nobody is happy with where we are today. Like, nobody's like looking and going like, wow, you know, that's it. Like no optimization left to happen here. I think everybody realizes like there are an endless amount of areas that, you know, they just look like opportunity for us. And so let's make sure that we're best in class all across. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, that is my shtick for what it's worth.
And it also seems like that is the stance that you have to take in any sort of space where there's like real competition. So I've heard you say in other interviews, in some way, shape, or form, you know, the solution to a sales intelligence platform or platform that delivers the type of insights that ZoomInfo does to its clients is there's the LinkedIn, however many 700 pound gorilla in the room. And on the other end, there's, I think this is kind of like a trope across SaaS, but there's these kind of, I would say like the 80-20 rule type of companies where they're willing to be 80% of the solution for maybe, I don't know, 60, 50, 25% of the price, mm-hmm. and try to like, you know, swipe some clients off the other end. And so you kind of have to have that relentless focus, or you're going to have pressure from competition on either side of the equation.
Yeah, actually, it's just an undeniable truth for any business that wants to grow. Like, if you're growing, it just means you're different than you were like at any given point in your company's history. And look, like, I look at who I am as a professional today, and I'm not stupid enough to think that, like, if I'm exactly the same way a year from now, that I'll continue to be as successful as we are. Like, I'm going to have to adapt to a new normal. I'm going to have to learn new things and execute in a way that's different when we're a, you know, when we're a $1 billion revenue company than when we were a $400 million revenue company. And everybody should actually just appreciate that as a fact in their profession, or appreciate that, like, they are at the, that's it. They've given up. They're as good as they're ever going to be. And that's fine, because they're just happy being this kind of, like, what, you know, not their full potential. And I think if we're constantly pushing ourselves to be a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better, like, that is a real thing you can become. A lot of us, like, we know the things we're not good at. We're just not really comfortable, like, just like diving into those things and just being like, okay, I'm not good at these things, and they're super uncomfortable to get better at, but I'm just going to be like uncomfortable for a while until I'm good at those things. Like, no one jumps on a bike and starts riding it perfectly the first time they jump on. It takes like a little bit of time and practice before you're good. And you can use that analogy in anything that you're in, anything in your professional life.
So, in terms of cultivating this type of culture that you're aspiring to, you've done 4 acquisitions for the company now. So Discover.org acquired iProfile, which you actually previously worked at, Ranking Software, NeverBounce, and then ZoomInfo. And then for the last one, we can get into like the whole branding of renaming and taking ZoomInfo's name.
Yeah.
But in terms of like that incorporation upon acquisition, I'm sure there's other, you know, characters that abide by that when you bring a new company into yours, but there's also going to be frictions there on those differences. How do you deal with something like that?
Well, yeah. So look, when you make an acquisition, you take over the culture of another company in a lot of ways. And, you know, when we made the acquisition of RainKing, one of the interesting things was we made the acquisition of RainKing, and we said, look, this is our culture. Now you're a part of this culture. And like, we're just going to tell you what it is. And you guys are this now. And if you don't like it, that's okay. We're not going to like, you know, force you to come here, but we're building something great, and this is the culture with which we're going to do it. When we made the acquisition of ZoomInfo, it was more like a merger of equals in a lot of ways. I mean, Discover.org was a bigger company from a revenue perspective, but ZoomInfo, you inherited a lot of things that they were doing better than we were doing. And so you have to be a little bit more careful about like, hey, this is our thing now, because you were like, you didn't really want to screw up the things that they were doing better than us. You wanted to preserve those things, but then sort of over a short period of time, make sure that the culture adapted. But, you know, look, if from the, does it come from me perspective? It doesn't take a long time post acquisition to realize that like, I'm going to be generally unhappy with the state of anything we have right now. And so like when we come into these things, it's like, okay, here's what I expect to happen in sales, and here's what I expect to happen in marketing, and here's what I expect to happen in engineering and product development and finance. And then everybody's just running at those goals. And when you see those goals in front of you the first day of the acquisition, it's pretty clear, like we all have work to do. And so you come in and it's like, it's not a celebration. It's really just a launching point for the next thing. And when we made the acquisition of ZoomInfo, I think what was very clear was, look, we think that there should be a public company that is focused on go-to-market intelligence, that is focused on the sales rep and the marketing professional. And we're going to build that over the next year or 2 years together. And we're going to go out to the public markets together. But to do that, these are all the things we need to be great at. And let's go make sure we're great at those things.
So in this way, you use that phrasing of you're not going to be happy with the status quo. You're going to always kind of have that pushing. I know you're a dad. I know you're married. But in terms of places where you derive happiness and satisfaction, like, do you even think about your company through that lens that like part of the objective is happiness, or it, like, I don't know, that's probably not the most graceful way to ask the question, but like,
it's an interesting question.
What are you pursuing through that work, kind of at a more philosophical level outside of sustenance? Because you're kind of past that point.
Yeah, I think, look, the unfortunate truth for me in this business is that I'm probably never going to be like truly happy with it, because I will always know the places where it's ugly. And then I'm always just going to be chasing after that thing. And as soon as we solve some problem or something is good, you know, there's going to be another thing that I realize we could be a little bit better at and a little bit better at and a little bit better at. So I am proud of the company that we have built. I'm proud of what we've been able to accomplish, but I also know like there's a, you know, a long list of things we could be doing much better than we're doing today. And I'm really not going to be satisfied with the company until we've solved that long list. And when we've solved that long list, I'll have created another long list of places we could be better. And so I don't think I'm ever going to be truly satisfied with the business. So I have to get that in other places. But yeah. I am like, you know, I am fulfilled, right? I am totally fulfilled by the work that I'm doing. And I think that's probably the more important question. Like, do I feel every day like fulfilled with my, do I feel fulfilled about the work that I'm doing? And I do. And then it's like, do all of our employees feel fulfilled with the work that they're doing each day? Do they feel like either like the work that they're doing is challenging and new and different and they like that work, or the work that they're doing is leading them to like another professional milestone along the way? And so I think fulfillment is something that I'm focused on much more so than like actual happiness.
Yeah. My company is barely over 2 years old, but I have a kind of very similar experience of like happiness is so fleeting. Like it's like cool. Like that was like a, you know, thumbs up type of moment where we accomplished this thing or solved it or, you know, landed the new client. And then it's just like, it's gone. And it's not something that I think I could have necessarily explained before doing it. And I appreciate the kind of distinction that you made there.
Totally. Like I think a lot of my, you know, when we IPO'd, a lot of my friends and my, you know, my wife's friends sent me messages like, wow, you know, it's so exciting. Like you should be so proud of what you've built. I'm so excited for you, blah, 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 blah. And like the interesting thing about that is like, these are people who I was with like, you know, 6 months ago and my business wasn't very interesting to them. It was like, yeah, here's this thing that we do. And they were like, oh yeah, Henry has a business. And, you know, then we IPO'd and it was like, wow, you know, wow, this is such a cool thing. And it's like, look, I have the same business today as I had on Wednesday of last week before we were public. But I think people wrap up a lot of like professional success around this like kind of like small point on the journey of building a great company, the IPO. Like it is cool and they put a lot of fanfare around it, but it really doesn't have a lot to do with what you're building. It's just a financial event that's exciting for a lot of people.
And externally, it's very legible, right? Like there's all sorts of stuff that, you know, as an outsider, we can't come to appreciate how big it was that you finally figured out that one automation that got the financial services lead to the right SDR. Like that's so legible internally, but externally it's like, I don't really know how to make sense of that unless I'm a fellow business nerd.
Totally. It's like a very, it's hard to explain to most people. So from a validation perspective, like, it's incredibly validating. The IPO is incredibly validating. But at the same time, it also tells you like the investors that are investing in your business at IPO, they don't really care about the business you have right now. They're investing in the business they believe you're going to execute on over the next like 5 years. And so there is like, and that happens anytime you take an investment. Like a VC firm coming in early stages or a private equity firm making an investment in your business, they're not making an investment truly in where you are right now. They're making an investment in where they believe you're going to take the business in the next 5 years. And so you have to feel pretty good about like, can you see 5 years down the road? Do you have the team that's going to get you there? And, you know, how are you going to execute really to perfection to get there?
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about how that's worked for ZoomInfo and really start with the fact that you bootstrapped the company all the way to 25 million in revenue and how rare that is, frankly, not just in terms of anyone getting to 25 million in revenue or being able to do it in a bootstrap nature, but kind of this narrative that the entrepreneur, the early stage folks, it's like, that's the story, right? You get a seed and then you get an A and then maybe you have some revenue then and whatnot. Like, you didn't follow that playbook at all.
Yeah, I didn't know that playbook, you know, to be fair, which is a blessing, and is a blessing because we started the business. I was 23. We put, my co-founder and I put $25,000 on our credit cards. It was very strange. I had this Chase card that had a $25,000 limit. I always thought it was a mistake, actually. But I was like, I had this great affinity to Chase because they like trusted me with a $25,000 credit card limit. And so you can think of that as my seed round from JP Morgan Chase. But we put money on our credit cards and we went out and started building our platform and building the data that we were putting in the platform. And then look, we were like focused on, is there, you know, we had to make money because we were going to run out of money. And so we brought in clients. I think 4 months after we launched, we had our first client and we put all the money back into the business and just kept like, you know, you take money in and you put it into marketing, you'd hire another data person, you put it into marketing, you'd hire another data person. And the business was able to sustain and grow that way. And it also kept you focused on the most critical thing. And you were in front of your clients constantly and they were telling you like, yeah, this is really great, but it would be great if you had this or that. And so like the efficiency with which you built the product was pretty remarkable. You really weren't like running any sort of like weird experiments that might find value. You were doing what the customer told you they wanted to do, because what they wanted you to do, because that's really all the capital you had to play with. And so I think it kept you focused on the customer. And so we grew it to, between 2007 and 2014, we grew it to about 25 million in ARR. And then we brought in our first institutional capital with TA Associates. And that, you know, look, that allowed my co-founder and I to take some chips off the table. And it kind of freed us to make really good business decisions that weren't so intertwined with our personal net worth. And so you could start like, you know, making the right decision for the business without having like your personal financial success wrapped up all in it. And so then, you know, then you really saw the business kind of take off from there.
Yeah. And it also is the type of thing where it also, you were in a position of leverage, not desperately like, hey, we're not going to make payroll
totally.
in 3 months or we have some sort of like enormous obligation. It's now a conversation between these investors, who's the right partner, what's the right timeline, and that kind
yep.
of position
yep.
contributes to the satisfaction. It contributes to the satisfaction of the building because you're like, you're with the people that you want to be with, as opposed to like being backed into a corner and taking whatever it is that'll
You got to pick the right investors for sure. And you had time to do it. I think the other thing is maturity is probably an undervalued currency. Like I was 23 when I founded the business. I was in no position to have like institutional investors on my board, or like, I didn't know enough about anything at 23 to like really be able to report to senior finance professionals. And so giving myself some time to really like know the business and understand the levers in it and trust myself as an operator, those were really important. That was a really important time. And even today, I also feel like, you know, you see companies like, you see companies that just like shoot up in growth. Like they get founded in 2011 and 2 years later, they're multi-billion dollar valuation companies. Like the leader just doesn't get enough time to mature as a leader. Like, it's your first company you launched and 2 years later you have a multi-billion dollar valuation and you're starting to think about IPOing your business and going on a roadshow. Like, there's no way I could have done that successfully 2 years into the founding of ZoomInfo. And so, you know, I feel kind of blessed that this is a overnight success, 13 years in the making. And because it gave me an opportunity to become a more mature leader and have new perspectives and understand the business better. And, you know, you find me at 25, something goes wrong, I like lose my mind, you know, like I, and at you know, at 37, I'm much more like, okay, that went not the right way. Let's learn from it, figure out how to be better at it, like with the same intensity that we would be before. But, you know, you get your emotions in check, you become a better leader as a result. So that period of time is like the maturity you get over that period of time is valuable and underappreciated.
And I can still sense that intensity, but you just kind of have it kind of more in control and managed.
Yeah, you're just kind of like more emotionally in control. You remember what you were like? How old are you, Aaron?
I'm 28.
28. Do you remember what you were like when you were 23?
An idiot.
Yeah, right? Like I was an idiot too. And like, you know, and I was when I was 25, but less of an idiot and, you know, less of an idiot when I was 28. And so as long as you're like emotionally evolving over that time, you're probably evolving as a leader too. But I think like so many people who start businesses is like, they don't want that. They don't want like time to become successful and develop themselves. They want like overnight success. Like that's the thing that gets dramatized and put on Business Insider or TechCrunch or whatever, is like, you know, Joe and his friend founded a company 2 days ago and now they have a $150 million thing. It's like, yeah, okay, that's cool. But like, give yourself a little bit of time, like breathe a little, grow the company a little bit, understand it better. Like not everything is a rush to put VC money in your pocket.
Totally.
The Going Deep podcast is underwritten by Piper Creative. Shooting, editing, and publishing quality content is overwhelming. We make it easy so you can save time, build your brand, and grow faster. Say hello at pipercreative.co.
Changing lanes a little bit here. One of the things that prompted me to follow up with you to get this interview on the books was a LinkedIn poll that I did that said, would you trust the competence of a marketing firm that acquired their clients through cold calling? Now, granted, I was doing a little bit of, you know, trying to write something in a way that would create some tension and some kind of aggression in the reaction, but you wrote a really good response. It led to the whole post itself blowing up, but you were kind of talking about how that even in the case of some of the best brands in the world, brands that have, you know, have invested more in advertising, invested more in marketing than anyone else, they still use cold calling as a part of kind of their macro business process and business strategy. So I'm just going to give the floor to you in general to kind of maybe reiterate a little bit more of your response to that. And then we can just kind of build off that.
Yeah, look, I think you caught me on like a Sunday afternoon or something. I had like looked down at LinkedIn. I saw that post and by, you know, you wrote it in a good, like the way you wrote it, like incensed me.
Yeah.
Because like, I felt like this was a, it's like, I think people forget that building a business is not just building something cool. There is like a business is so much more than like a great product that adds a bunch of value to customers. That is not a business. Like a business has all a whole other sets of things that you have to do to get it right. And maybe the most important one of those things is going to market and going to market in an effective and an efficient way. And the best brands in the world have cold calling as a motion that they do to acquire new customers. And I think what happens is we get in our heads about this thing. We go like, ooh, I didn't like it when that guy called me, or cold calling's gross, or it's like a car salesman. And it's like, look, if you think you have a solution that can add value to a company, why wouldn't you want to tell the people who could get most value out of that? Like, shame on you for building a great thing that you're not telling the world about. And sometimes the most effective way to do that is to pick up the phone and get your ideal buyer on the telephone and say, John, I've spent my life for the last 7 years building a solution that I think will add value to your business. Can you give me 15 minutes to show you it? Like, what is so embarrassing about that? You know, like, I just don't understand all of this weird stigma around like a cold call. Like, get over it, pick up the phone and tell people what you have is valuable to them. And they'll probably buy it from you because most people are trying to add valuable solutions to their businesses. So like my sister, I had like a fight with my sister about this.
Just generally? Oh, God.
No, just this as a concept.
Okay. And it's I'm glad that I didn't set it off.
Yeah, it's probably part of the reason why I responded. My sister sells jewelry. And she's a jewelry designer. And she's always thinking about, like, how do I grow my business and how do I find new customers? And I told her, like, Shiva, here's a Zoom info license. Like, why don't you go on ZoomInfo and target the jewelry buyers at the brands that you see as like perfect buyers of yours, and then go like build a marketing campaign around them and tell them about your product and tell them about the product you're building. She's like, nah, no, jewelry's just not, it's just not that kind of business. I go, really? Because like we have a bunch of customers who sell jewelry who are on our platform. So I don't know why you think your brand is so like unique that it won't work this way. And she said, but I poked and I poked and I poked at her. And what it really came down to was she goes, you know, I get these messages from people in my email and I ignore them. And I'm like, okay, so what? She's like, I probably get like three of them and I ignore them. Yeah, so what? Like, you're not playing for the person who ignores your email or ignores your phone call. You're playing for the person who doesn't. And so if you call 20 people and three of them are willing to take, you know, a meeting and 17 of them aren't, who cares about the 17 who aren't? You're looking for the three. And by the way, you have told me, my sister, you have told me over and over and over again that you make jewelry that would kill if it was at Free People or Urban Outfitters or any of these brands that you're targeting. And yet you're embarrassed to go tell the jewelry buyer at those businesses whose job it is to find jewelry to sell to their market that you have something that's a perfect fit for them. You either don't believe it or you've built up some bullshit in your mind about selling your product and service, which you're just gonna have to get over if you wanna build a business. You're just gonna have to get over it. People aren't just gonna stumble into your office and go like, hey, here's $1 million order for your jewelry. I heard it's pretty cool. Like, you're gonna have to do work. That's part of your business. It's part of building a business. And so I think in every business, like doing everything you possibly can to be in front of the potential buyer who you could add value to, who you could help do, you know, you could help them do their job, grow their business, make something easier, more efficient within their company. Like, shame on you for not figuring out how to get in front of them. Why'd you do all the work? You did all the work to have a moment with that buyer. Like, now you should be doing all the work possible to make sure you have as many like repeat opportunities in front of buyers who could be perfect for your product or solution. And that means you're gonna have to be a little uncomfortable doing things that, you know, maybe you didn't expect that you had to do cold calling when you started your business. You thought you had just built something that was really cool and the floodgates would open. Like, but that's not how business actually works.
If ZoomInfo doesn't work out, you're gonna have a future as a sales trainer.
I think like ZoomInfo is working out because I might be a good sales trainer.
That's for sure. Another part of that though is there's this connection between that sensibility and the connection to metrics, because there's also a degree to which, you know, whatever the value is of that $1 million jewelry buyer, who, what have you,
yep,
if you can break down to some degree the number of calls, the number 100%. Of contacts, and actually make it tangible that these micro actions can lead to that macro outcome, that's what animates the action for folks and kind of reframes it.
Totally. And so you should make a commitment that says, you know, I'm not sure if cold calling is going to work or, you know, building an email campaign is going to work, but I'm going to try it. I'm going to try it for a year. I'm going to track how many calls I make, who I make the calls to. I'm going to track how many emails I send. I'm going to track which emails perform better than the other emails. And for a year, which is not a long time in the life of a company, for a year, I'm going to tweak and tweak and tweak and tweak and tweak and tweak and tweak. I'm going to track all those metrics and I'm going to see the outcomes. And then I can build something that's predictable and repeatable and continue to build, you know, a team around that. But yeah, you absolutely have to understand the metrics that lead to the outcome. And then you got to tweak the conversion rates in every single place where you have the opportunity to tweak.
Makes sense. So in terms of the data that makes up ZoomInfo, can you talk a little bit about how that gets refined and how that gets differentiated so that it actually becomes a moat? Because some of the things before of like the competitors that come in and undercut a SaaS product by, you know, doing a 50% type of job, like data can be that moat, but can you articulate for people a little bit about how it becomes that moat?
Totally. So at a high level, ZoomInfo provides information on companies and information on professionals at those companies. We provide it on 14 million companies, 120 million professionals. The best way to like really wrap your head around why that's hard, because you know, just hearing a number like 120 million, you don't really wrap your head around like what that means. Like, you know, if you count from now to 120 million, I think it takes like 3 years or something like that. And if you think about those as data points, business information is constantly changing. And it's so different than consumer information, which I think in our minds, when we think about data, we think about our consumer data. And so like my personal email address, it's been the same for the last 20 years. My cell phone number, it's been the same for the last 20 years. But in that same period of time, my emails changed half a dozen times. My phone numbers changed five times. The location of the offices I've worked at have changed seven times. The company ZoomInfo is twice the size today as it was last year. We have new technologies. It has more revenue, more offices, new products, new executives. So the business world is constantly changing. And so what we've built at ZoomInfo is this core AI and machine learning engine that takes literally millions and millions of unique sources that run through this engine to make decisions about when to publish something, when to unpublish something, how to make decisions on when we see Henry Schuck as CEO of DiscoverOrg, how to not let that make its way into the data set, but instead to know, oh, Henry Schuck at DiscoverOrg, who's in Vancouver, Washington, who's, you know, in this article is actually Henry Schuck at ZoomInfo. And so don't mess up the data just because you see a new data point come in, but use machine learning to understand when to publish things and when to change things in the platform. And you think about any business, just about every business looks different on December 31st than it did on January 1st. And so keeping track of the vast amount of change that happens in a business, you know, every day and every year, it takes those millions of sources and then that unique machine learning and AI engine that we're using to make decisions on, that we're using to make decisions so that we can deliver 95% accuracy to our client.
And you can't just replicate that and you know, spin it up in a couple of days.
Pretty hard to replicate. Like we have, on top of that, we actually have 300 researchers who are feeding the machine learning engine because, you know, machine learning learns, right? And one of the inputs that we have into that is this team of 300 researchers who could take like, if we decide to add a new source for employee count data, that source comes in, we have our research team go like, this is right, this is wrong, this is right, this is wrong, this is right, this is wrong. And they're getting it, they're gonna call up a company and say, hey, do you guys still have 150 employees? And they'll say, no, we actually have 500 employees. Great, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. And that's feeding the machine learning engine to get smarter and smarter and smarter over time.
Gotcha. Couple last questions, and then we'll ask our standard ones to wrap up. Henry, I appreciate how generous you've been with your time here.
No problem.
One of the questions was, so you became a billionaire, maybe officially in light of the IPO and the market capitalization?
Uh-huh.
What did you do or where were you when you realized you were a billionaire?
I literally haven't done anything different. And by the way, for what it's worth, I didn't sell a single share of my holdings in ZoomInfo at IPO. So I still own all of my shares because I believe this is a long-term opportunity and the company will be, I think we'll be able to execute on the plans that we've put in place. And I'm a long-term shareholder of ZoomInfo. And so, you know, whatever it says in the numbers on the S1, just know like my life didn't change at all between being public and not being public. Clearly my net worth changed on paper, but you know, I'm in this to build a really great company and that's what I'm trying to do. And my life has not changed as a result of those numbers.
I dig it. And then in terms of that new space as being a public company CEO, whether it's lawyers, PR people, whatever, like things that they try to kind of hedge you away, or you literally legally can't necessarily talk about the company that you used to. How has that changed?
Yeah, I mean, look, I can't I can't tell you about like future results, and you know, there's a set of things from an SEC perspective that I can't talk about. But look, you know, I feel like I was pretty open in this conversation, and I didn't share anything that was material non-public information here. And so I think what's important is for us, the thing that I wanted to protect against internally was we have this great culture around our sales and our account management teams that is celebratory when we hit our numbers, and there's goals that we put out that we're constantly pushing to hit. And what I didn't want to do, what I didn't want to have the IPO do is really suck the life out of the company in that way, because we just like layered a bunch of compliance on top of it. And so we've done some things internally to make sure that we can preserve that culture, because that's an incredibly important part of who we are.
I dig it. Well, I am excited to see what the long term holds for you and the company. The fact that you haven't sold anything is like as bullish of a signal as I could identify. So that's really cool. If people want to learn more, follow along on the journey moving forward, what digital coordinates can we provide people?
Well, here's my email, henry.shuck@zoominfo.com. So if you want to send me an email, henry.shuck@zoominfo.com, and it's S-C-H-U-C-K.
Perfect. We're going to link that in the show notes. It's in the podcast app. You're probably listening to this right now, or in the show notes above or below, wherever you're looking at this. But before I let you go, Henry, last question. I want to give you the mic one final time to issue an actionable personal challenge for the audience.
So the personal challenge I would tell you is the professional that you are today is almost certainly not the professional you need to be to hit the goals that you have in your mind. And so I would tell you, lay out for yourself over the next year the things that you're not really great at today that you expect to be great at a year from now, and then hold yourself accountable on that journey. I mean, I have that list. I look at it often. There are some places that I'm doing better at now, and there are some places that I haven't done better at, but I know what that list is. And if at the end of the year, I'm not looking so good on that, it's only on me for not executing against that. There's no way if you're looking to grow a business or be a great leader, or a great salesperson, or a great professional, there's no way who you are today is who you need to be a year from now. And don't lose that year.
How do you keep in touch with that list? So is it something you like reflect on in the morning, weekly? Like how do you keep your focus on it?
I mean, so I write it down and then I email it to myself. And then, you know, I don't have like every month I go back and look at it, but I probably go back and look at it 3 or 4 times in the year. And when I look at it, I go like, okay, great, that's off the list. But like these 5 things are not off the list. Like one of the things on my list was have a successful IPO. And I, you know, I talked to my chief of staff the other day and she's like, well, you can cross this one off the list now. I was like, great, that one is off the list, but those 4 in the middle, like I have not done those 4 things yet. So.
I love it. Henry, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Aaron.
We just went deep with Henry Shuck. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the end of this interview. I'd like to direct you to another interview, another episode in our back catalog, which is with Jason Wolf. Jason Wolf is one of the most successful and prolific entrepreneurs in the city of Pittsburgh. He's founder of multiple successful companies that have all been acquired for tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. I think it pairs really nicely with this interview with Henry. Check it out and reach out to me personally on Twitter or LinkedIn if you'd like a personal recommendation for another show from our extensive back catalog.
Thanks for listening. Connect with Aaron on Twitter and Instagram at AaronWatson59.